From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. A Winston-Salem surgeon is working with the Institute for Justice to challenge a state law. It blocks him from buying medical equipment that would lead to lower costs and more convenience for his patients. The 2018 elections could help lead to a renewed push for election redistricting reform in North Carolina. You'll learn why. Higher education faces a number of challenges. You'll hear from an expert who focuses on two: the lack of viewpoint diversity and the overall decline in academic quality. And we'll learn about association health plans and their possible role in healthcare reform. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Former President Barack Obama has said that he believes today's growing U.S. economy can be traced to policies implemented by his administration. Conversely, President Donald Trump says that the low unemployment rate and job growth is due to his actions. So which president is correct? John Locke Foundation senior economist Roy Cordato joins us to assess the economics behind both of those claims. Roy, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Donna.
First, give us your general sense as an economist of what's happening in the country today.
Well, I think things are good. I mean, obviously, we hear all this good news, a 3.7% unemployment rate, which is tremendous. Most recently, 4.2% GDP or growth rate. Those things are really good. And not just unemployment low for white rich guys, but for the masses, right? All demographics. Are more fully employed. Wage rates are going up for the first time in many years. So, I think the economy looks very good, and I think the growth is real. In the past, I'm not sure I would always have said that, but I think most of its growth is not, especially since the Fed is actually moving in the opposite direction by raising rates. So, looks good.
Well, former President Obama says it's because of the policies that his administration mm-hmm. implemented, particularly after the Great Recession of 07, 08.
Right.
What do you think of that?
Well, he would have to prove that. I mean, he put in place policies that would do the opposite, right? So if you're going to put in place a number of policies, right? I mean, his so-called stimulus package, which was his major centerpiece economics package for the whole 8 years, did nothing. In fact, it made things worse, right? He said in 6 months, the unemployment rate was going to go down to below 8%. Well, the fact is it never got to below 8% for two more years. And that had nothing to do with the stimulus package. It's mainly because he stopped doing harm. The stimulus package basically created more debt. It transferred a lot of wealth around, but didn't do anything to expand the economy. Then he went ahead and raised taxes in 2013 on highest income earners, right? He raised top marginal tax rates. He raised capital gains rates. These are not things that any economist, regardless of your stripe, is going to say is a good idea to do when unemployment rates are over 7%, which they were in 2013. So if he's going to say that it's his policies that are, just now taking hold, he'd have to point to which ones and how they are somehow consistent with advancing economic growth. I mean, there are other things I could go into, the Affordable Care Act, which raised costs for business. I mean, we can go down the line.
Lots of regulations.
The Paris Climate Accord. That was a huge wet blanket sitting on top of the economy. Businesses were faced with massive costs of complying with that if it ever did go in place. So what are you going to do? Are you going to invest in that environment? No, you're going to sit back and hold on to your money.
So Mr. Obama believes that it's just taken a long time for the actions you just described to take hold, and he believes that's why there's economic growth.
Right.
But then President Trump reacted to that and said, oh, no, that's not the case. What's happening is because of the policies that his administration has enacted. So assess Mr. Trump's argument.
Well, first of all, let me just say that the Democrats and Trump supporters said, well, this recession of 2008 was so deep – right. It was so deep that it just took a long time to climb out of it. That's something else, has nothing to do grounded in economic reality. There's no economic theory that says the deeper the recession, the harder, the more slowly the economy is going to grow. In fact, historically, that just has not been the case. You would expect actually very fast growth coming out of a very deep recession if you create the right economic environment. That said, I think Trump is right in this case. By and large, he did what – actually, I wrote a piece in 2009 suggesting that if they want to get out of this recession, what they need to do is lower marginal tax rates, cut corporate tax rates, cut capital gains rates, do not put in place any CO2 regulations. Right, which is just a massive tax, and so I said all this stuff. If you want to get out, if you want fast growth, so on, that's what you need to do. Trump came in; he pretty much did all that. Right? He must have read my piece.
I'm sure that's it.
he pretty much did all that. Right? He lowered tax rates and taxes overall. He dramatically cut the corporate rate. Now, he didn't do anything to the capital gains rate, and that's. Not, I think, because he didn't want to, but because I think he really couldn't in that setting. And some this tax cut 2.0 or whatever has some adjustments for capital gains in that. He also pulled out of the climate accord, I cannot emphasize how important that is, because those are major, major regulations that amount to a huge tax. Maybe a carbon dioxide tax or something like that. All that was hanging over the heads of American businesses and sending them a strong signal. It's very likely not to be a profitable situation in the coming years. And so he did all that. And of course, it wasn't because so much of the policies he put in place, was because the policies he got rid of, right? The higher tax policies of Obama, the regulations of Obama. If you get rid of these policies and allow entrepreneurs to respond to consumer demands, this is what's going to happen.
In fact, in terms of regulation cutting, he's been on a tear. His administration has just been really digging through a lot of rules and regulations. Perhaps, Roy, because he has a business background and understands what happens?
I think so. I think there's he's cut with the auto industry. He's getting rid of these really stringent corporate average fuel economy standards. Again, he got rid of the climate accord. He's not pursuing the climate regulations that the Obama EPA was pursuing.
But
he streamlined lots of.
But yet he loves tariffs.
He does, and I think that's the thing that's hanging over. One of the main things that's hanging over the stock market right now. I mean, we see stocks really. You think, wow.
It's not that
they're doing bad, but there is a roller coaster. They are well off of their highs of over 26,000, the Dow. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he is out there threatening major tariffs on Chinese goods. This nonsense, I think, about the French wines that he's come up with lately. I
mean, he was tweeting about that.
Yeah. I think it's just a bad policy, and tariffs never help the economy.
We've been talking with Dr. Roy Cordato. He is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. He wrote this really interesting piece. Roy, thank you.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's Certificate of Need law was supposed to help control healthcare costs by blocking unnecessary construction of new healthcare facilities or the purchase of unneeded medical equipment. A recent lawsuit challenges the CON law. We're joined by the man who filed the suit. Dr. Gajendra Singh is a surgeon based in Winston-Salem. Joining Dr. Singh is Josh Windham, Institute for Justice attorney who's working with him. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first of all, we're going to talk about the specifics of your case, but first I'm going to turn to Josh. Tell us, what does this CON law or Certificate of Need law do that's blocking your client?
Yeah, so for people who aren't familiar, a Certificate of Need is effectively a government permission slip to provide healthcare services. Not all healthcare services are regulated under North Carolina's CON law, but many are, including hospitals, hospital beds, ambulatory surgery centers, and things like MRI scanners. In North Carolina, you can't purchase an MRI scanner if you're a physician unless the state has predetermined a need for that scanner in your planning area. North Carolina regulates MRI scanners by county. So Dr. Singh is in Forsyth County. He's actually not allowed to purchase an MRI scanner because the 2018 state medical facilities plan didn't project a need for a new scanner this year.
Dr. Singh, you wanted to get an MRI scanner. Tell us why and why this law is blocking you from serving your patients.
Well, I've been practicing as a surgeon for quite some time, and my specialty is to doing liver, pancreatic, GI cancer, besides doing all the general surgery. So my patients do need quite a few scans. And when they come back and tell me that how much it costs, sometimes more than what they make in a month, it is heartbreaking. Like when they sit in my office and cry and tell me, like, you know, I just went to the emergency room a couple of weeks ago and I got a $10,000 bill and I make $2,000 a month. You know, where do I get the money from? So that kind of like, you know, pushed me in the direction of providing affordable care to start and open my own imaging center. And MRI is a big equipment, a big part of imaging where either it is brain, chest, body, or bones, you know, detecting tumor. Besides CT scan, it is a very important part of diagnosis and management. And that was my reason to start the imaging center and try to get MRI.
So if you got the MRI scanner, basically your patients wouldn't have to go elsewhere. They could go to you, who's already providing the treatment, get the MRI scan, and from what I understand, what you're suggesting, at a much lower cost.
Right. So our cost for the patient who do not have insurance is just a single flat fee. Almost everywhere else, you would pay an imaging fee plus a reading fee. We have combined all those. And like a non-contrast MRI at our center is only $500. At some place, it can cost you up to $3,000 to $5,000. And in CON law is based only on county, but we have patients, like last week, we have patient who drove down from Tennessee 3.5 hours to get a CT scan done. So we have patient now from Tennessee and from Charlotte, from Raleigh, and from Virginia. They're driving 2.5 hours. So it doesn't make sense to restrict MRI or CON law to a county basis when we can provide services to people who are driving over 100 miles.
So you're a doctor. You want to provide these services for your patients. Let's pivot back to Josh Windham, who's your attorney. What is the state's argument against Dr. Singh being able to do what he wants to do and get this MRI scanner?
Well, we haven't gotten their formal argument back yet, but the sort of long-time historical justification for con laws is that they're necessary to control healthcare prices. That just has never been true ever since con laws have been enacted. I mean, con laws originally started getting enacted in the 60s. They started taking off in the 70s after significant lobbying efforts by the American Hospital Association. And the rationale the whole time was that they were going to keep costs low for patients. The exact opposite has occurred, as the federal government has repeatedly recognized the fact that con laws actually prevent new entrants into markets keeps prices high by preventing competition that would otherwise lower the prices. So, you know, con laws have not worked to control prices since they've been enacted. It hasn't been true in North Carolina. It hasn't been true across the country.
That is the voice of Josh Windham. He is an attorney with the Institute for Justice. You're also hearing from Dr. Gajendra Singh, who is a surgeon based in Winston-Salem and has his own imaging center where he would like to have this MRI scanner. Now, Dr. Singh, you're a doctor. You're not a lawyer. So what made you say, this is something that I feel so strongly about that I'm willing to go to court? Why is this so important to you?
Well, for decades and for years, you know, we have tried as a healthcare professional to provide care to the patients, and the politics, the hospital, they have not worked for the public and the community. I have tried to provide the charitable services, affordable services as much as I can, and the con law and the big corporation gets in the way. So easiest thing for me to, instead of going back to the state and asking them to repeal it, which just was not going to happen because they are backed by, like, you know, billion-dollar hospital lobby and all this stuff. And Institute for Justice, they were kind enough. They understood what I was trying to do, not trying to get rich, but trying to provide the affordable care to the community, especially the poor people. Forsyth County is one of the poorest county and adjacent areas. And they were able to step up and just help work this lawsuit.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing to that. I mean, these days, people are increasingly skeptical of the healthcare system, right? People think that hospitals are not out there for them. They think that insurance companies are out there to scam them. Pharmaceutical companies are out there to scam them. They think doctors are out there to scam them. And nobody trusts anybody in the healthcare industry. And the last thing government should be doing is preventing a doctor like Dr. Singh, who wants to actually help patients get scans they can afford at transparent prices, from doing exactly that. That is the last thing government should be doing.
If you, Dr. Singh, and you, Josh, as the attorney, win this suit, what happens? Does this con restriction go away if you win?
Yeah, so the lawsuit is specifically targeting North Carolina's MRI con requirement. If we win the suit, the whatever court issues the final ruling will strike down the law as unconstitutional and issue an injunction against enforcement of the law against Dr. Singh.
And so the next step would then be Dr. Singh could get the MRI scanner, and then what would happen?
Well, my next goal would be to get my own MRI and continue to provide the affordable services, which I have been doing. And if I have enough volume, if we can make more money, I may be able to bring the prices further down.
You two have both been involved in raising awareness about this issue. As people have learned about this story and the particulars, are you seeing the light bulbs go off with people saying, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Why do we have this law that's stopping you from getting this MRI machine?
Yes. The question was, what can you get and what not? And I said, we can get ultrasound, echo, X-ray, and CT scan. And her question was, why not MRI? It is another piece of equipment. I said, that's what we don't understand. So because it's not harming patient, it's not radiation. We are not doing anything which can hurt patient. So it does not make sense to give permission to all other equipment, but not MRI scanner. So whenever I go and talk to anyone, anywhere, this question comes up and it doesn't make sense. Like, you know, why MRI is being controlled?
How about you, Josh, as you're talking to people say, wait a minute, why is this law in place?
I think the most common response that I've gotten so far is one of two responses. One is either they don't believe me. I explain this law and they say, there's no way this is real. There's no way this is actually how healthcare works in North Carolina. How have I never heard about this? And I agree. I mean, I hadn't actually heard about con laws until I started looking into this issue a number of years ago, and I was blown away to find out that these laws are on the books. The other response I've gotten is, well, North Carolina has some pretty explicit constitutional protections against things like government establishing monopolies. How is this law actually on the books?
Well, the people who are moving forward with this suit are Dr. Gajendra Singh From Forsyth County, a surgeon who is hoping to get an MRI scanner, and his attorney, Josh Windham, with the Institute for Justice. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One consequence of the 2018 elections, redistricting reform might return to the legislative agenda in North Carolina. That's a prediction from John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood.
This is super close. The McCrory loss to Roy Cooper was 0.2%. The closest gubernatorial election in American history until 2018, but certainly one of the closest in American history, very, very close. I anticipate North Carolina being close for years to come. One of the implications of that, as I've already referred to, is redistricting questions. I am a strong proponent of redistricting reform. I believed it when the Democrats were in charge. I believe it when the Republicans are in charge, because I try to be consistent, even if I'm consistently wrong. And I do believe, by the way, that there will be a strong push for redistricting reform in 2019. I think Republicans will be more amenable to it than they were in the past for two reasons. One, suddenly you're not so sure you'll be in charge in 2021 when the maps get drawn. But frankly, more importantly, the state Supreme Court is now a 5-2 Democratic court. Now, I mean no disrespect to our latest Associate Justice, but I'm here to tell you, if the Republicans get the sense that, as happened in Pennsylvania, there will be a state constitutional case filed, and it will get up to the Supreme Court, and Anita Earls will draw the maps, That starts to change the political calculation a bit about what to do.
Hood suggests observers should harbor no illusions about the 2018 election's impact on state courts.
The appeals court and certainly the Supreme Court has moved to the left. That means that any policies that you like as a conservative are in danger of being struck down. But there's no real reason. They're in danger of being struck down based upon whatever citation the majority wants to make. This is not just new things you want to do. These are old things you already did that you thought were already upheld by the Supreme Court. But they won't overturn precedent. Yeah, I don't believe you should nurse any such fantasies. So in the judicial situation, you want to get in federal court if you're a Republican or a conservative, which wasn't the case until recently, but now it is very much the case. It also means that, as I said earlier, that gerrymandering is a different storyline. All you have to do, again, is look at Pennsylvania, think through how that might work out. The same provisions, the Pennsylvania, very general, nonspecific general provisions in the Pennsylvania Constitution are also in our Constitution. So we'll see what happens.
That's John Hood, chairman of the John Locke Foundation. He argues that 2018 election results, including judicial elections, could boost interest in redistricting reform for North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Higher education in North Carolina faces a number of challenges. The head of the state's leading higher ed watchdog used a recent speech to focus on two of them. Jenna Robinson is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. She asked her audience to consider problems linked to a lack of viewpoint diversity on campus and the decline of academic quality.
I've chosen those because I think they really go to the heart of what education is and what it should be. It should be a place where students go and learn how to reason critically, how to analyze, and how to be prepared for a future, no matter where it takes them. And I think in order to do that, academic quality has to remain high, and there must be viewpoint diversity in the academy.
Robinson started with viewpoint diversity.
I define that as an environment where multiple views are not only permitted, but encouraged. Where faculty and students employ their power of reason to search for the truth. And that used to be the modus operandi of universities, to search for the truth. Unfortunately, that is not always the case anymore. Heterodox Academy, which is a bipartisan group of faculty who support viewpoint diversity, has done some really excellent research on this topic. And what they have shown is that American universities have leaned left for a long time. And that left-leaning tendency, that long-standing left-leaning tendency, for a long time wasn't a problem. As long as there are some people with different political perspectives in every field and every department, we can assume that eventually someone will challenge claims that reflect ideology more than evidence. But they also found that beginning in around the 1990s, as the greatest generation began to retire, things changed. The greatest generation contained a fair number of Republicans, even among academicians. And when they retired, they were replaced by the baby boom generation. And that generation contains somewhat fewer Republicans amongst the academy. So in the 15 years between 1995 and 2010, what they found is that the academy went from leaning left to being almost entirely on the left. And now conservative professors are found almost exclusively in schools of engineering and other professional schools. In most humanities and social science departments, only about 5% of professors are conservative.
What about the ideological breakdown within individual campus departments?
In about 60 of the most most elite universities in the country, the most competitive universities in the country, engineering looks all right. For every conservative professor, there are 1.6 liberal professors, and specifically, this is a partisanship index, so this is Democrats to Republicans. So for every Republican, there are 1.6 Democrats in an engineering department. No problem at all. That's pretty balanced. You get to political science, and for every Republican professor, there are 8.2 Democratic professors. If you move up the list, if you get to philosophy, for every one Republican, there are 17.5 Democrats. In classics, it's 1 to 27. In sociology, it's 1 to 43. And in religion, it's 1 to 70. At these schools, the researcher who did this work found no registered Republicans at all in anthropology and communications departments.
Why does the head of the Martin Center for Academic Renewal spout these statistics?
This is a problem, I think. Regardless of your own political your own personal politics. And the reason that these are problems is because now there are questions that don't get asked anymore in academic departments, or questions that aren't taken seriously. Important philosophical questions. Questions like, are humans a blank slate? Does human nature exist? Are all differences between human groups caused by society? Or are there real differences, say, between men and women? These are questions that aren't asked or are given very little attention in the academy anymore because they've become unpopular, just even to ask those questions. And this kind of orthodoxy is very dangerous to the academy. First, it's bad for scholarship. Everyone in the academy does their colleagues and their students a disservice by not challenging cherished beliefs. The good people at Heterodox Academy say, we fail as colleagues and as scholars when we allow unjustified dogmas or simply insufficiently justified claims to go unchallenged. It's also bad for students because teachers are failing to teach students the most important skill, which is how to think. If teachers shield students from strong counterarguments on the issues that they care most about, then they set students up for confusion or anger when they later encounter people who think differently. And I think that there is evidence of that in the student protests that we've seen recently.
Speaking of students, they also bear the brunt of the second challenge, lower academic quality. Jenna Robinson of the Martin Center highlights recent survey results.
They found out that only 28% of college graduates who they surveyed could name James Madison as the father of the Constitution. Almost half couldn't recognize that senators are elected to 6-year terms and House members are elected to 2-year terms. And that 10% of college graduates thought that Judge Judy sat on the Supreme Court. You haven't heard the worst part. The worst part is that this was a multiple choice test. So the right answers were right in front of people to choose, and some of them still chose Judge Judy. It gets worse. According to the National Assessment of Adult Literacy, only 29% of 4-year college graduates read at an advanced level. I would expect that number to be 100%. What is college for, if not to teach students how to deeply read and understand books, novels, and written material that is so important to interact and engage in an enlightened, knowledge-based society. They also found that the literacy rates for adults with associates and advanced degrees also are at low levels, and that over the past 30 years, they've declined.
Despite this lower quality, college students are scoring higher grades than ever.
A's now represent 43% of grades awarded today, which is up from only 15% of students got A's back in 1960. In fact, an A is now the most common grade that university students receive, and 73% of all grades awarded are either A's and B's.
What's the outcome of this decline in academic quality?
An employer survey recently released by the University of North Carolina System in 2015 suggests that graduates of the state's 16 public universities, especially those from the less selective schools, are deficient in terms of their written and oral communication, work ethic, and workplace etiquette. And these results mirror national employment surveys. I believe our universities can and must do better. I think we owe it to our young people and to ourselves to do better.
That's Jenna Robinson of the Martin Center for Academic Renewal. She's discussing declining academic quality and a lack of viewpoint diversity on college campuses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Ask any North Carolinian about health care or health insurance, and they're likely to tell you that they want greater access to care at a lower cost. Recently, the Trump administration announced an effort to provide more access to affordable health insurance through what are called association health plans. The John Locke Foundation's healthcare analyst, Jordan Roberts, joins us now to explain exactly how these plans work and the role that states like North Carolina will play in determining how employer and trade groups actually set up their plans. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
What is an association health plan?
So these association health plans are group health plans that are sponsored by either an employer-based group or an association, a trade or business association. And they are set up for the purpose of providing health benefits to their members and to people that have a common business interest with that trade association, or now, based on these new rules, can be all over the United States. They don't have to have those geographic restrictions anymore. So it really opens up access to groups that do business together, have a common business interest in what they do, and now can be anywhere in the United States.
How does this relate to Obamacare? And I guess what I'm getting at is, in your description, does that mean that, let's say that I work for Smith Production Company and they offer health insurance as part of my benefit for working there, do I have to take my insurance through them, or could I just say, you know, I've got a better plan over here from the Construction Workers of America health plan?
Sure. So you could opt out. And so what it does for businesses is it sets up different way of individuals to band together, either individual working owners, small businesses, or industry groups, and they can band together, use their power, their marketing power and bargaining power to negotiate lower rates. And really the biggest question in this matter is the question of when groups and individuals can band together to associate. And under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, these individual groups and self-working employers were classified under the law as individuals. And so, therefore, they're subject to the restrictions and regulations of the individual and small group market. The large employer market, which these two are regulated separately under Obamacare, the large employer market offers a lot more leeway and are not subject to as many of these restrictions under the Affordable Care Act. So under the new rule, these individuals or employer owners can get together and be treated the same as large employer groups under the Affordable Care Act to get that same favorable regulatory treatment to provide more flexible health benefits and just provide cheaper plans than the ones that are being sold right now under the Affordable Care Act.
Is this a new idea or is it just kind of a loosening of the regulations?
Right. No, this isn't a new idea. They've been around for a while. These plans have existed in the past, but they've been the regulations have been a lot more strict in the past because there's been examples of fraud and these plans becoming insolvent. And so under the Affordable Care Act, to really eliminate the risk of this, the Affordable Care Act would view these individuals and these smaller group plans as individuals. They're governed by what's called a look-through doctrine. So they would look through the association, view these individuals as individual people buying insurance on the individual market, even if they're small employers, which are they're still subject to a lot more of those Obamacare regulations. So what this rule really does is open up the fairness of the of how these groups can associate and be treated under the Affordable Care Act.
It sounds like if a person goes this route, that they have a lot more leverage. And with leverage, you have the potential for maybe greater amounts of benefits or a lower cost. Is that what we're really talking about here?
That's right. So if you are allowed to be exempt from some of these regulations that the Affordable Care Act places on individual and small business group plans, then you can provide more tailored coverage to the members of these trade and industry associations because their interests are a lot more aligned and they can provide more affordable coverage because they're not subject to these regulations. And it's just a better deal for these groups that can't afford the coverage that the Affordable Care Act is providing them in the individual and small business markets.
Jordan, here's what I've never understood about the Affordable Care Act, and that is that there's so many requirements in it that, first of all, the cost shoots up because
right.
any insurance plan that qualifies under the Affordable Care Act has to do certain things. But it just makes common sense to me. I wonder what you think, that everybody's life is different.
Right.
Everybody's at a different point in their life. Mm-hmm. They prioritize things differently. That we should be moving towards what you're describing, that more tailored opportunity.
Right. And these association health plans, they really give individuals and businesses the freedom to associate with the people that they do business with every day, the people in their community, because before they were restricted, these plans were restricted to either a bona fide business interest, which was very narrowly interpreted, or a metropolitan area. They had to be in the same state, really. So now when the Trump administration opens up these rules, the business interest is more broadly interpreted, so you can associate with all your clients, all your member employers. Take the Chamber of Commerce, for example. All those people that are members of the Chamber of Commerce could potentially be in this health benefit plan. So it really opens up, like you said, a more decentralized, localized approach to providing health benefits for association group members that have a common interest together and have been hurt by the Affordable Care Act for so long.
I think those of us who are used to more traditional health insurance through an employer, for example, we're used to knowing that, okay, it's our employer's plan and mm-hmm. it's administered by a certain insurance agency. And when you choose to opt in, that's it. But what you're describing sounds to me almost like it's possible I would be in a plan with somebody from the state of California.
That's right. And so if you could band together and create a health insurance benefit plan to provide only the benefits that your certain trade or industry association group needs, then you have more personalized health insurance and more affordable coverage for what people need. And that's really what these plans are providing relief for from Obamacare.
Jordan, tell me about the role of the states. Now that the Trump administration has loosened up these rules, what's going to happen in North Carolina?
So in North Carolina, we have rules in place for these multi-employer welfare association plans that have been in place for a while, because after there was some instances of these plans going bad, the states really got full broad authority to regulate them, which is still the case with the new rule, which is important to note here that the states still have the broad regulatory authority to impose reporting, insolvency, and disclosure requirements for these plans to be sold. So what North Carolina has in place is for these older traditional plans that were restricted by industry or metropolitan geographic barriers. But now with the new rules in place, the states really have a big role to play in how these new types of association plans can operate in the state market. So North Carolina right now is currently looking at the new rules to see how these new association plans would operate within the new rules, and what North Carolina can do to potentially make these plans more accessible. So right now, we would hope that the North Carolina General Assembly and the Department of Insurance would not do anything to make these plans harder to access.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.